Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last Friday, I interviewed a debut author named, or so I thought, Margaret B. Jones. She had been getting rave reviews for her so-called memoir about a hard, dramatic childhood in South Central Los Angeles. Gripping stuff. In the interview, she talked a tough and tender game about her life in South Central.
It's a deadly game, and I'm not condoning in any way. If there was a way I could, you know, touch a button and make it end, I would make it end. If I could be a martyr for the cause and gang violence could die with me, I would take that.
It turns out it was a game of fraud. Her story was made up. We were duped. So were others in the media. It's not the first time. But shouldn't we all, the publishers, the reviewers, the radio hosts, know better? This hour, On Point, bogus memoirs, faked memories, and why they fly. You can join the conversation. Remember Oprah and the James Frey memoir scandal? Why are we here again? I'm embarrassed. What should we do? We are going to hear a lot of perspectives today, including yours. Joining me first from New York is Charlotte Abbott, contributing editor for Publishers Weekly. Charlotte, welcome back to On Point.
Tom, hi. Thanks for having me.
Sorry about the circumstances of having you here. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Charlotte.
Jack, we've roped you in here yet. You had nothing to do with this baby, but now here it is in our lap. And I said yesterday and I say again today, I'm embarrassed. It's embarrassing. It's frustrating. It's infuriating. Let's just review for a moment the facts of the case, at least as we know them. We had so-called Margaret B. Jones on last Friday, and then it comes out over the weekend into Monday. New York Times had written up her book. Others had praised it. We'd picked up on that. It was very affecting. It was brought to me by a producer in tears, so moved by this book. Then we learn her sister had seen her real sister had seen photos on a New York Times website, recognized that this wasn't any Margaret B. Jones. This is Margaret Seltzer. She didn't grow up in South Central L.A. She grew up in a nice L.A. neighborhood called Sherman Oaks, where the median home sale price recently is $800,000, not exactly a shack in South Central. Nothing in here was true. She didn't run with gangs. This wasn't her family she wrote about. She wasn't a foster child. She was raised by her biological parents. She didn't get a gun for her 14th birthday. She wasn't a victim of child sex abuse. And on and on and on. I feel like an idiot. Charlotte Abbott, should I? Should everybody? How does this happen?
Well, I have to say it's not all that surprising that it's happened again. This issue comes up repeatedly because of practices in the publishing industry by which books are not fact-checked at the same kind of standard that there would be for print publications, newspapers, magazines. When publishers read books in advance of publication with a kind of scrupulous eye, it tends to be for libel, meaning how they could get sued for statements the author might make versus whether the information in the book that's stated as factual is actually factual. So as long as publishers do not bring fact-checking to their publication process, this issue will undoubtedly come up again and again.
But, I mean, fact-checking, I mean, never mind the details. You could have gone on, you know, for years with every little detail in this book. Hard to track down because it was set in the 1980s, which is now a while ago. But this is the absolutely fundamental facts of the case about who even this really was and what her life was. Jack, we've got a lot of email on this, and I'm going to read some through this hour. Here's one from Keith, who emailed in from who knows where around the country. He says, Just promise us that if ever again one of your intrepid producers comes to you with a pitch that includes the words debut and memoir in the same sentence, you will shout them out of your office. And boy, I'm tempted to do just that, Jack.
Yeah. By the way, on emails, there's a wonderful bunch of them on the web now. One man writes, I guess I should write my memoir about how I was a White House intern seduced by Bill Clinton. Oh. The fact that I am a man and in my 50s, that makes no difference. If I tell them I'm the 30-year-old woman, I suppose they will accept that, especially if I write compelling emails.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, if the publishers turn out a product, and really they're in they have almost Federal Trade Commission problems, it seems to me, here, with truth in merchandising at stake, and that unless they independently verify the facts in their books, I think that the people are just going to there'll be a flight from books. In other words, it's going to be expensive for them and for authors, but unless they do that, and these things keep happening, people aren't going to be reading. So I think the industry has got to change its practices and do what magazines and newspapers do, which is to have some objective person, not the author. That's like asking a batter to call his own strikes, but to ask an objective outsider to do the checking on their books.
But there's so many questions here about, you know, the stuff itself. I mean, she's white, Margaret Seltzer, and we're sort of wrapped because, oh my, you're white, but you grew up in a black community in South Central Hill. We sit miles from that gangland that she describes. And so, you know, she's got real stories from the hood. Boy, we're you know, you've got our attention now. And then it's hard to push back because Charlotte Abbott, she's saying, look, I was a victim of sexual abuse as a kindergartner. I mean, you know, what kind of on-air host is going to go after a woman who was saying she was abused as a 7-year-old and ask her to prove it? Or, I mean, they don't, you say publishers don't fact check even the fundamental facts here, but are we supposed to hire a detective to go back to the public records in South Central, see if she ever went to school, find her in the welfare rolls? I mean, at the end of the pipeline, should I be doing that, Charlotte?
Well, I don't think it's actually your job, although...
And yet I've got a lot of listeners, lots, and they deserve
true.
To have the real thing on the radio, not sit around for an hour empathizing with a big fat liar.
I think the responsibility does rest with the publishers to at least make the initial certification to you that the information is true and accurate. Unfortunately, what they do is trust the author, and when they sign a contract with an author, there's an indemnification clause that in which the author states that if there's anything factually untrue in their book, they are liable. So again, we're going back to that's how the publishers are looking at this in a sort of a legalistic sense. But you're really talking about the pain of the betrayal of the reader as the end result. There's a sort of interesting note on that with the James Frey book. Remember, he
A Million Little Pieces went on Oprah, made her club, sold 3.5 million copies. Unlike this one, they put out 19,000. Now they're all called back. So there's no big money here. But I'm sorry, Charlotte, you were saying.
No, exactly. Well, there was a very, very clean sale on James Frey book. I mean, not a lot of them have come back to the publisher. That means that we can assume that around 3.5 million people actually bought and presumably read the book. But a very small percentage of them joined the class action suit against the publisher when the material in the book was found to be fraudulent. And I find that kind of interesting because in the end, I believe that the settlement for that suit was less than $100,000. And you had all those readers out there who literally bought his story, and yet they didn't quite rise up and say, I want my money back.
Yeah. Let's put
that as a bookend at the other end of this conversation.
Right. Readers are part of this equation, I guess. Here it is, January 06. Oprah talking about the controversy over fabrications in James Frey's best-selling memoir, A Million Little Pieces.
Every day I was reading email after email from so many people who had been inspired by it. And I have to say that I allowed that to cloud my judgment. And so to everyone who has challenged me on this issue of truth, you are absolutely right.
She got James Frey on the show, went after him, grilling him about the book, including about how he said his girlfriend Lily had committed suicide.
She hung herself.
I mean, that was one of the details I altered about her. I mean,
Just a little detail, whether or not she hung herself. Jack Beatty, we went back to Margaret Jones, really, that is Margaret Seltzer. One of my producers, the producer who booked her, talked with her yesterday. She was very apologetic. We tried to get her on this show. She's not here. She won't come on. Her publisher saying, that's it. She's not talking. Well, she had plenty to say last week, Jack, but I mean, an apology after the fact, it clears up the facts, or it comes because the facts have been cleared up, but it doesn't do much for our credibility, for the credibility of the publishing world, for the sort of sense of basic trustworthy honesty in this big American conversation.
Yes, and so much of what you know, we call our culture depends upon belief in the written word. And I think one of the things that's happened among tastemakers, people in publishing, the editors, is that generations of TV melodrama have kind of, I won't say dumbed them down, but sort of given them conventions in that they accept now in books. For example, it is accepted all the time in books that there can be nonfiction books, that there can be long passages of dialogue as if the person had a tape recorder and as if the person were there, when in fact this is from somebody's memory, and yet we all accept that that material in quotation marks is accurate. It's almost never accurate. And that's just an example of the sort of lowering of standards, as if, well, it's talk. The person could have said something like this. But when you see long bits of writing that's in quotation marks, that's from somebody's memory, it's almost always reconstructed.
Here's an email from another listener. Albert says, I was a rapt listener on Friday. Here's what worries me most. Like a lot of people, I've written an as yet unpublished memoir, one I've labored over like no other work I've undertaken. Aren't these frauds making it even more difficult to get compelling true stories in print? Albert, I don't know about that, but it is going to make it a little more difficult to get them on the air on this show because this is just too much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour, sadly, about bogus memoirs and the one that bit us. Margaret Jones Nay Seltzer's made-up memoir, Love and Consequences. She wrote it. It's a fraud. We put her on the air. Here she is last Friday talking about the life that she never lived in the neighborhood in Los Angeles and South Central and how she's still haunted by it today.
It is a concern in L.A. You know, you have to mind your color codes. You don't wear the wrong thing in the wrong neighborhood. If you're from a neighborhood, you don't go to the wrong neighborhood. You know, we say you always have to look in your rearview mirror. You always have to look in your rearview mirror. You have to keep a sense of everything that's going on around you. And to this day, I mean, if I go see a movie, I'll go sit in the corner and look at everybody and have three different possible escape plans in mind just in case something pops off.
Ouch. We're looking in our rearview mirror now. We feel like we're sitting in the corner. Who is to blame here? Lying authors, irresponsible publishers, gullible media, hungry for a good yarn. What about readers who don't want to read unless it's true? Did you hear Margaret B. Jones right here on this show? Did you believe her? And should I have been interrogating this purported child abuse victim on the air? What was your address? Who was your first grade teacher? We've been joined by Charlotte Abbott, contributing editor at Publishers Weekly, and our own Jack Beatty. Right now from New York City, we're joined by Lev Grossman, book critic at Time Magazine, author of Codex and Warp. Lev Grossman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
What's to be said? It's a couple of years since it happened to Oprah. It's happened to us. It's happened plenty of other times. What's your big view, Lev? Why is this going on?
It's just it is so bizarre, and I think, you know, the angle that I look at it from which I look at it,
yeah,
that I find it most interesting is really, you know, getting into the, well, on the one hand, the psychology of the person who does this. This woman Seltzer, she didn't get a big payday for this book, and obviously she won't now. This wasn't really a money thing. This was about the fascination with being in the position, and this is something that I think everybody in this country is sort of a bit drawn to, of being the one who's overcome adversity, being the special one who's lived this narrative of having been dealt a tough hand. That's the name of the first chapter of the book, the hand that you're dealt, and having overcome it. That is kind of the master narrative, I think, of our culture right now, in the same way that the Horatio Alger rags to riches story was the story of the previous century. Now it's about this sense of self actualization in the face of adversity. People want to live that narrative, and if you haven't, if you can't because you weren't dealt a bad hand, then sometimes you're driven to faking it, and that's what she did.
But it's so interesting that, I mean, she's going all the way here posing sort of in hip-hop blackface to do that. And it's not the first time. I've got an email here, Lev, from a listener, Rick Reeves. He says, I'm a regular listener, usually impressed with the interviews, but for God's sake, your credibility is tarnished here. Based on that interview with ghetto girl Ms. Jones, didn't the media learn from a million little pieces that white, middle-aged authors masquerading as homeboys and or drug addicts need to be checked out before they get near a microphone? I mean, should that in itself not be a pretty big flare to us, Lev?
I mean, what's fascinating is that this is, we're in a culture that's obsessed with authenticity, and one of the things that really almost defines authenticity in contemporary America is the experience of the poor black person who is the victim of prejudice. And the idea that this can be convincingly synthesized by somebody who hasn't gone through it is just immensely confusing, I think, because we think of this as what's real, right? As straight from the streets, and the idea that somebody can convincingly make it up. And she was convincing. I mean, she looks silly now, but I know plenty of people, black and white, who were taken in by her.
She says she's worked with, earlier in her life, she worked with, gang organizations to get people out of gangs. She learned a lot from that. She wanted to convey it. She thought this might be the best way to do it. Thanks a lot, though.
Yeah.
I mean, why not just put it in a novel? She's a good writer. She's definitely a good writer. Is there something, Lev, in the publishing industry that wouldn't want this if Margaret Seltzer, child of comfort in Sherman Oaks, came forward and said, I've got an insight into the gang world of South Central. I want to put this in a novel and tell the story. Why not do it straight up?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the idea that I think that a white woman could convey the black experience in any way that was authentic, it's just not acceptable right now. The publishing industry wouldn't go for it. I think people wouldn't go for it. So she's forced to put on this imposture, which is a gross and revolting imposition on her readers. And yet, you can see how publishers and readers, you can see that they want, in a sense, they wanted her to do it because they couldn't take it the other way.
Nobody wants Gone with the Wind anymore. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. William, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listen, I'm a big fan, and I was wondering if you were going to do this show, and I'm glad that you are.
Well, we want to keep it straight up with our listeners, so we're trying, Bill.
Yeah. I heard some of the show. I actually turned the radio off because although I had no clue that she was a total fake, I found her really annoying and very disingenuous, and I was about an inch from calling. But I said, I'm not going to bother. She's not worth it. Because I was just wondering why no questions about, and maybe they did come after I turned off the radio, but no questions about, well, how did you make it out? What's your message of what you do to get out? You know, it was all just like this poignant potpourri, you know, and then the sociological stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're torn between interrogating and empathizing, because in a way, if this is the word from the street, don't we want to hear it? Don't we want to learn from it? There was a moment. Listen with us, William. Here's just a little bit. I tried to get a bit more, and I did not interrogate her. I'll give you that. Not in that, you know, give us, prove your story to us. But I asked her here about her family, and her foster mother, fictional, Big Mama, Jones, says she didn't write about all the kids in the home where she grew up. Big Mama, African-American grandmother with four other children that she was caring for in this little house in South Central.
Yes. Actually, you know, kids came and went, and I kind of, you have to take that artistic vision. I'd read so many books where there were so many people you couldn't keep track of anybody, and so I kind of focused on main people, but there were other people who came and went, and there were, you know, probably at any given time up to like eight people.
Okay. Artistic vision, she says she took. Maybe artistic license. William in Nashville, should I have stood right up there and said, wait a minute, is this a piece of literature or a memoir? Is it just literature? Is it fiction?
I don't know. I can't put myself in your shoes. But more searching, I just felt there was a lot of, and I might be misremembering, but I felt there was a lot of, how did you take that? That was so tough.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people that have really been through tough things, they don't mind hard questions.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're not looking for a bunch of sympathy and an outpouring of, you know, guilt. they're really interested in searching questions.
Oh, boy. Guilty. I tried to think of it as empathy, but maybe it was just smarmy sympathy. Let me get another call. William, thanks for yours. John in Boston, you're on the air.
Tom, how are you?
Well, I've been better. Thanks.
I heard your show Friday, and I felt a little sorry for you. I thought you were gushing a little, and I'm glad you're having this show today. You got sort of bringing it all out.
But what are you supposed to do? A victim of child abuse, she made it through the streets. It was she was dealing drugs. She lost, you know, torn away from her family, lived with eight foster families, we're told, sexually abused in kindergarten, dealing drugs at 12 years old. If that's true, doesn't that deserve an empathetic hearing?
Yeah. I found her story to be really interesting, but it just didn't ring true. And I thought it just didn't seem true. And I was wondering... You mentioned that you felt a little embarrassed, and I thought if you could go into that a little more, because what was it actually that you were embarrassed about?
Well, I'm embarrassed to have put a hoax on the air and treated it as the real deal. I mean, we rely on a kind of stream of things that go by, that come to us, books by the mountain. And here this one was from a reputable publisher, Riverhead, part of Penguin. New York Times had given it glowing reviews. You know, we bit, but I don't want to bite and bring bogus stories to our listeners as though they're real. That's embarrassing.
Yeah, I hear you. I was wondering, your guest Jack, what does he think about maybe that should the publisher's feet be held to the fire? Should someone else be taking the heat for these hoaxes?
Jack, take this heat away from me. What do you say?
Well, I quite agree, John. I said earlier, I think publishers have to warranty their books. They have to say, we have checked. We have done due diligence on this product. And to the best of our ability, it is a faithful record of reality. And now that's going to mean, of course, that what we call in journalism the story that's too good to check, that's going to have to mean that that story goes by the boards. And does a book lose something because of that? And is that one of the dirty little secrets of this whole enterprise in publishing, where they allow the batter to call his own balls and strikes? I think that is part of it. They don't want the story they want to keep the story that's too good to check because it's tasty and delicious, and resist it?
Maybe this is Charlotte from
Publishers
Weekly.
Yeah.
Maybe there is a middle ground here. I mean, there are economics to the book publishing industry that have to be taken into account. This woman got, as Lev pointed out, this was not about the money. This was a woman who got less than $100,000 for her book, which means that the
publisher... And now nothing. Yep.
Right. But the kind of costs that would be involved in checking every fact in the book are what's preventing publishers from undertaking that. It's just, it doesn't make sense in the financial model. The returns on their investment just aren't great enough to justify that kind of fact-checking. But maybe...
And yet the return on a string of frauds has got its own downside.
Yeah, but, I mean, how many frauds are a publisher having in any given, like, 10-year period?
A particular publisher? Maybe not so many, but I'm looking back here, you know, through this one and the one with Misha De Fonseca recently, this fake memoir of Holocaust years, and J.T. Leroy and Tom Carew and I mean, you know, you can go back and find a lot.
That's true. And, I mean, they go all the way back to Jerzy Kaczynski and even Roots, the
elements
Alex
there.
Haley's books, the research was questioned in that. I mean, this has been a long-time persistent problem for, you know, more than 30 years, not just an invention of our age of media transparency.
Yeah.
But I was just, I mean, as far as the middle ground goes, I mean, maybe when someone submits a memoir, they could make available some of the key characters to corroborate the facts. I mean, you know, publishers have just sort of stood by defiantly and said, we can't do this, it costs too much. And then you have someone in Jack's position saying they have to check everything and guarantee it. And, you know, that conversation, it's been a stalemate. We haven't seen any change, which is why we're here now. So maybe there's a middle way that can negotiation that can be brokered going forward that will put the media in a better position, like you, Tom, when you're trying to decide whether to take a book or not. I mean, it would be a sad world if you didn't cover any memoir because you were afraid of getting burned again.
Maybe so, though. I mean, the New York Times has not gone back and talked more to her and, you know, and to her editor, Susan McGrath, who was the daughter of Charles McGrath, a big writer at the Times, former editor of the Book Review, the New York Times Book Review. And she said, Sarah McGrath says that, you know, here we had this author bringing people forward who, out of this fictional past, had professors and writers and others vouching for her. I mean, in a way, Lev Grossman, she had herself gone out into the middle ground. She was sort of not just writing the fiction, but to some extent living the fiction, which made it a little harder to poke through. Here you are, Lev, you're a book critic and a good one at Time Magazine. I mean, is it too much to ask that we get to the bottom of this? I almost feel like that, you know, great line in the Jack Nicholson movie, you know, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown out there.
Well, I mean, I think Charlotte's point is well taken. The kinds of margins on which the publishing industry operates just don't permit that kind of labor-intensive work on any given book. And it is, you know, then this is a case where she did actually bring people forward to back up her story. I mean, she put a great amount of effort into
the
perpetrating
fraud.
This fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And if you, when you hear her talk, I mean, it's clear that she's in some weird, screwed up psychological way inhabiting this character. I mean, the kind of detail that she goes into in the book, it's just astonishing. And you can see that there's some kind of powerful psychological fantasy at work, which is quite disturbing. And, you know, and really, the power of psychosis is quite difficult to penetrate, I think.
She says she wrote a bunch of it. Now, she now says she wrote a lot of it sitting at the Starbucks in South Central. Oh, my gosh. Maury's calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Maury, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I have two comments, Mr. Ashcroft. You raised
Ashbrook, please. Yes, sir.
You raised the question as to whether you should feel bad. And having been a riveted listener last week, you should not. I believe that you and your producers do a generally fine job of vetting your guests, and it's just possible to get hoodwinked, as people have. So don't feel bad. However, I would make a distinction that if, of course, this were a self-published author coming to you, I think the vetting process should be different. My second comment is that, having been so enraptured by what I heard, I immediately went out and ordered the book online.
Sorry.
And I'm expecting it in the mail today, and it presents me with a quandary as to whether I wish to read it or not. And I think when I get the package in the mail, I'll be sitting on it for a day or two, maybe talking with my wife and seeing how I feel about whether I would want to read the book after all.
Well, I can tell you, as Lev Grossman says, it makes a fascinating psychological sort of 3D experience to read it, now knowing that it's all made up. It gives you an extra layer to think about, but I am not promoting the book. Maury, thanks for calling. Michael's calling from Hampton, Virginia. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I have a somewhat different take on it. I think that this lady is clearly a talented and persuasive writer. I think she pulled off a very slick job. Rather than beating my breast and all of the pseudo-psychoanalysis going on, I'd rather have an interview with her and find out how she got the details, how she wove them together, what motivated the book, and where she intends to go from here. I don't want to cast the air. I want to read her stuff and read more of it.
Well, we've tried and tried hard to talk with her on the air. We did get back to her, as I said yesterday, my producer, in that conversation, which ended up in a few tears on her part, but she was contrite. She said that she sort of justifies it to your observation, Lev, saying, you know, these people in South Central, they don't have a voice. I was trying to give them a voice. This seemed like the way to do it. But yet, Charlotte Abbott, there's got to be a distinction drawn between a very talented writer and a very talented liar. Or is there? Charlotte?
Well, I mean, you know, we expect our memoirs to be told in a novelistic style. We want the first and foremost their stories, and the people with the imagination to convey those stories well might, you know, cross that border between nonfiction and fiction. It's funny because 30 years ago, most debut authors were pushed to write autobiographical fiction, and that was the more sort of fashionable medium for first efforts.
In other words, sort of like Hemingway. I was in this milieu, now I've written a novel out of the milieu.
That's right. And mm-hmm. And part of the fun for the reader was what's true and what's not. But on the, you know, in the other way, the sort of idea of a Romana Clay and were the, you know, who were these characters really, and all the kind of rivalries between writers and the veiled characterizations had a kind of mystery of their own.
That was
but
then.
Now,
we're in another world now. Charlotte, I know I have to let you go. We're so grateful to you for being here. Charlotte Abbott with Publishers Weekly. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about bogus memoirs and the one we bid on, and we're sorry about it. Margaret B. Jones, nay, Seltzer's made-up memoir, Love and Consequences. We talked about it last Friday. Talked with her. She wrote it. It's a fraud. We put her on the air. Here she is, Margaret B. Jones, with us last week talking to me. She wrote that at 12, she was running drugs on the streets of South Central Los Angeles. I asked her what that was like and if it was common. You were 12 years old, and what, you would sort of be out on the street if someone appeared to be in the market for drugs, they'd approach you, or you'd approach them, sort of check them out and give the sign if it looked good.
Yeah, that's what we call a runner. And you just sort of check everybody else out, give them the heads up, okay, you go here, you go here. You're sort of basically directing traffic.
You were 12, though. Was that common to be that young doing that work?
You know, it's funny. I had a great editor at Riverhead. And she'd say 12. I mean, it's just so hard for me to wrap my head around that, because in the rest of the country, 12-year-olds are playing with G.I. Joe action figures. And I was thinking, let someone play with one of those in the hood, 12 years old. They get whooped on. That's baby stuff. So I think it's just a whole different perspective. For us, 12 is older.
Whooped on. Baby stuff. I had a great editor, such a great editor. She couldn't even wrap her head around it well. It wasn't true. It wasn't true at all. Lev Grossman is with us, book critic at Time Magazine. Jack Beatty is here. Kathy's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have to say, when I listened last week and when I heard that it was a phony, the first thing I thought of was you and On Point. And I thought, oh, no, he must feel terrible, because it was so, you were so passionate. You were such a great interviewer with her. And it's a shame, but you know what? Give yourself a break. I think the onus is on the publisher. And as an avid reader, I don't care if it's real, if it's fiction. I don't care. And it's too bad that The Wire, that great HBO series, is going off the air, because why couldn't she write for that? The people who produce and make that show, David Simon, Dennis Lehane, they're not Black Americans from Baltimore. They write believable, great, entertaining stuff. So why does it have to be passed off as a memoir?
Well, Kat, now that's interesting. On the second point, I totally agree with you. I'd be a lot happier if Margaret Seltzer of Sherman Oaks, nice, cushy community, had ended up writing for The Wire, because she could, looks to me like she could do a great job. But you say, Kathy, you don't care if it's real or not, even when it's presented as real. I mean, the reason that I was extending her that passion, that empathy, was because this was supposedly about our fellow Americans, our fellow human beings. You want to, you know, sort of run the plank out and listen closely. If it's bogus, if it's made up, you know, I care, don't you, if you're sort of shaping your view of what the world really is off it?
No, I do care if it's, I want to present it as fiction if it is fiction. Yeah, I was really mad. I read A Million Little Pieces, too, and after that came out as a fake, I was pissed. I'm a recovering person. So when I read that, I thought I was really angry. No, I think that a good story is a good story. Let me know at the beginning, but I'll still read it if it's fiction. But yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, well, they're recalling all 19,000 copies, and I suppose they're headed for the shredder. But Kathy, thank you very much for that. I want to bring another voice into this conversation from New York City. We're joined by James Atlas, president of Atlas & Company, publishing house there. He spent a lifetime on all sides of the book business. He's a former New Yorker contributor and New York Times editor, founding editor of the Lipperviking Penguin Lives series. He's author of The Great Pretender, 2005. There we go, a semi-autobiographical novel about coming of age in the 1960s, also of a biography of writer Saul Bellow called Bellow in 2000. James Atlas, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
What do you take away from all this? You've been around the block. Are we idiots for having put Margaret Seltzer on the air? And what about Riverhead Publishing? Are they failing in their role as a publisher to have published her? And what's going on with these seeming to come to the surface with more frequency these days?
I don't think it's useful to point fingers at this stage at any particular editor or publisher. To me, it seems endemic. It's a publishing-wide problem. And when I read publishers, as I did in the Times this morning and in other articles, saying mm-hmm. we do the best we can or we take the author's word, this is the way it's done. This is not the way I do it, not with the memoirs that I'm going to be publishing, and it's not the way I do it as a writer either. I think there's a real clear distinction between fiction and nonfiction. When you publish nonfiction, you can have available to you documents, journals,
right.
interviews, and you can certainly get to know the author very well. One of my authors is in prison in California. I've even gone to see him. I mean, he's becoming a friend. You have to know who these people are.
But Sarah McGrath, the editor of this book, worked with her for 3 years, right through the James Frey, Oprah scandal years on this thing. She was shown, you know, what were she was told were pictures of these made-up siblings and all the rest, and it never emerged. The truth never emerged.
She never met her, as she says.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
Also, other people in the story were not interviewed directly by the publisher and editor. Again, it's no one's particular fault in this instance, but the standards are very low in publishing, and they're not questioned.
Do you think, James, do you think a publisher would have picked up this first-time unpublished would-be author if she had said, I want to write a novel about South Central and the real life there? Lev Grossman is with us from Time. He says, no, because she's not black. She wouldn't have been seen as having the authenticity to write a novel about this. Would race matter? Is a novel of that kind even appealing? Or do publishers only want the patina of nonfiction these days?
If you're asking me this question, people
yes.
do want nonfiction, but nonfiction has to be written as nonfiction and has to be nonfiction. You can't go around making these vague distinctions or blurring the distinction between the two out of a kind of avaricious eagerness to have more memoirs out there. It is not that difficult. I've been a journalist and a biographer. It's not that difficult to ascertain the truth.
Do you think they would have picked her up if she offered them a novel based on this, which is all she really had? She didn't have a nonfiction, honestly have a nonfiction work to offer.
If it was well written as a novel, sure, why not? I mean, what's the difference? You can write anything in fiction. Just don't pretend that you've written nonfiction.
Jack, and yet there's clearly an appetite in this country today for the nonfiction presentation, that the sort of, you know, I don't know if that Hemingway period is still quite as much with us, where people want to read the novelized form.
I agree, nonfiction and memoir are very attractive, so go find someone in South Central, teach them how to write, work with them, get a memoir from them.
What do you say, Jack?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the authority of experience, I mean, Whitman's credo, I am the man, I suffered, I was there. Hard to argue with that. That has the authority of experience. And to many Americans, maybe to many readers, that counts more than invention. You can invent something, but that's just your story. But the nimbus of true story, especially if true means raw and rough and crude, boy, that recommends itself to so many of us as reality. Burke has a wonderful passage someplace about being in a theater watching King Lear, and suddenly there's a fire down the street. Well, the theater empties out as people go to see the real fire, because there it is. It actually happened, and I think that people find it easier to identify with the real than they do with the invented. The odd part is that the invented is probably invariably more compelling, more moving, more involving. And yet the sales of literary nonfiction are just parlous. I mean, people are rejecting it in favor, it seems to me, I don't know the numbers, but I would guess, in favor of this kind of authentic first-person account.
Liv Grisman, do you agree? And why do you think that's happening? Not just in book publishing, on television, you know, it's fictionalized, but everything has this form, the sort of CSI form of the reality, even now when it's fictionalized. And in print, well, you see what's out there.
I'm glad you brought up television because, of course, the sort of correlative on TV is reality television, which, as we all know, is called reality television, but it is heavily scripted and,
right.
and edited. I think there's so much hunger on the part of American consumers for things that are real and authentic that you see real and authentic being dragged through the muck. I mean, everything is advertised and authentic. You get reality on TV, on TV that's not particularly real. And you end up getting fake memoirs just because the market is so hungry for real, authentic things that paradoxically people try to pass off things as real because they're not, even though they're not, because the market wants it.
They want it. Let's hear from the market. Annie in Brookline, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Everybody just said what I wanted to say, and that is that this sort of like desire that we have for authenticity, it seems really extreme to me. And I would go even further than what Jack said about that authenticity is better than invention. I think it counts even more than expertise as well. For example, if you had a bunch of sociologists and experts on gang violence, which I know that's what you do, but like you have those on the air, like we think it's really interesting, and they actually know more about gang life or whatever overall than an individual person does. But we find the individual story really compelling. And I've noticed this, like, Holocaust memoirs, all kinds of sort of stories about, going through these hardships. It even reminds me of that whole thing with Joseph Ellis, remember, where he said he was in Vietnam?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In order to prove his authenticity, even though he was a professor and an expert on the Vietnam War, why isn't that enough?
So the authenticity is the catnip; it's the compelling thing. But then invention is ultimately maybe more compelling in the reading, and there we fall right into that. Annie, thank you for that. Let's get another from Andrea. Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I realize your callers have been talking mostly about the bogus memoir, but I'd love to bring into the fold, I work with at-risk youth here in Boston, and it resonated. I was hook, line, and sinker with you.
When I talked with Margaret Jones Seltzer on Friday, oh boy, even though you work with kids in the streets.
And the thing is, the reason that I fell for it was because it resonated with me. There are so many stories that are true and that are real, and I hope through all of this that doesn't get lost. I think you are empathetic because, how could you not be? And I don't want your listeners to lose sight of the fact that there are girls and there are young men and young women who are living these lives, that a bogus memoir, albeit that's what it is, there are definitely kids that day in and day out are struggling with these lifestyles.
And you know it from your work, and we don't want to lose that empathy, but in a way that's what's in the gun sights here. If you get too many, too much cynicism that grows out of this kind of fraud case. Andrea, thanks. Let's get one more from Chesapeake, Virginia. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling. I agree with most of what has been said, but another point that I would like to make is that I think the reason some of these people are successful is because we bought into a lot of us have bought into the stereotype of what really goes on in the quote unquote hood, and then she adds a layer of her being biracial with white and
right.
Part Indian, and no one wants to question her because of that and because of this alleged sexual abuse. And I think if we stop buying into the stereotypes, maybe it'll go a long way to preventing some of this stuff from happening.
John, I appreciate, the funny thing there is that when this book was introduced, one of the things that sort of promoted it was that it seemed like it wasn't just the caricature, just the cartoon violence in the streets. I mean, here was the extra layer, Lev Grossman. She gave us that layered sense that there was not only violence, but love and tenderness between the shootouts and, better than the cartoon.
It is astounding. And you look at the book, you can't read it now because everything looks like unintentionally funny. But like I said, I know people, black and white, who read this and were moved by it. And they sensed authenticity there. And now that we've learned that it's not authentic, it's very confusing and frustrating to know that your one's own sense of what's authentic is not infallible.
Let's hear once more before the I'm afraid the door slams on this one. Here's Margaret Jones again from that interview with a caller calling in and you know, with a little skepticism, questioning Margaret Jones Seltzer about her alleged allegiance to this older gangster mentor in the book, Krasiak. Let me get a call from Valerie in Norfolk, Virginia. Valerie, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, sir. I want to thank your guests for being on board today. I'm in Norfolk, Virginia, as you said, and I just want to know, why do you idolize the gang member that recruited you into the gang? I mean, what's the... I always hear that here's a guy who, you know, he's older, but you're only 12 and he recruits you, but for some reason, even though after he's shot and he dies, that's somebody you still look up to and someone you still idolize. I don't understand that.
Margaret, why with Krasiak, your OG?
Well, idolize is a strong word. I mean, he was someone who, I don't think with the part that I'm reading, you're really understanding what he was. And I don't even think if you read the book, you could understand who he was. And I don't even think if I wrote an entire book just about him, you could understand who he was. But this was a person who was very smart, was very educated, and would sit down with us little kids who no one cared about and give us his time and give us his lessons and his knowledge.
Wow. Even if you read the book, you wouldn't understand who he was. No, you wouldn't, because he didn't recruit her. He didn't die. He wasn't shot. He didn't exist. But we've got the little lilt of accent there, and we've got an author, James Atlas, who just isn't going to stand down. You know, just a few days ago, there she was. It was all working for her.
Well, I'm still puzzled by this unwillingness to see fiction as fiction, to sell it as fiction, to send it to the public as fiction. Why, if this book had been fiction, would it have been any less moving? I mean, is Charles Bach's new novel less moving because it's fiction? No, I just think it's the expectation. It's the expectation of truth.
It's a good point to end on. We want to see fiction as fiction and nothing else. James Atlas with Atlas & Company, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Lev Grossman at Time Magazine, thank you for your insights, Lev.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, wow, I hope we don't have to have this conversation again anytime soon. Oh, thanks man. A lot for being here, Jack.
Okay, thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.